Hey, everybody. Mike Malloy here. Welcome to today's program, or tonight's program, or Thursday's program. If you're watching on Ustream, you'll notice that there isn't a whole lot of coordination between what you're seeing and what I'm saying. And there's a reason for that. But we won't even get into it, all right? It's just, as they say, one of those things. The phone number here is 877-996-2556. It's about 8 past the hour. If you want to join in the fun of frivolity, that's the number to call. Looking over some of the more bizarre items that that have crossed the desk here in the past couple hours, I got an email yesterday from Gordon in Oklahoma City. And he writes the following. Mike, during the program yesterday, you brought forth the topic of an alarmingly high rate of suicides and post-traumatic stress disorder experienced by our military service members. During the discussion, I could not help but wonder if those experiencing depression, PTSD, or self-medicating with drugs and alcohol are being cast under the spells of those practicing priestcraft. That is to say, the chaplains, as they are known to their fans. There could be some substance to this hunch involving the usual suspects. Here goes. And then Gordon includes an excerpt of a letter published August 9th this year to the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, from the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. You know what that organization is. That's one put together by Republican and military officer Mikey Weinstein. Here's an excerpt. Quote, our letter addresses a particularly pernicious subcategory of proselytizing that must also cease immediately. The military also substitutes evangelical chaplains in the place of professional mental health care for service members suffering from mental health conditions, especially post-traumatic stress disorder. These reports have recently become increasingly frequent and alarming. Among the many types of shocking incidents and illicit and dehumanizing practices reported to the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, have been the military's teaching of creationism as an actual bona fide means of suicide prevention. What? The use of a parachurch military ministry's evangelical Christian program to treat PTSD. Third, service members seeking help being sent to and proselytized by chaplains instead of being sent to mental health professionals. Articles in official military publications stating that finding Jesus is the only solution to the mental health problems faced by members of our armed forces. Mandatory mental health training inside chapels, plus countless so-called spiritual fitness events and programs being promoted as mental health solutions, end quote. And then Gordon closes with, it was Robert Greene Ingersoll, who was born on this day 177 years ago, who said, quote, ignorance is the soil in which belief in miracles grows, end quote. Well, the report by the Military Religious Freedom Foundation was contained along with a letter from Mikey Weinstein, founder and president. And he wrote a letter to Secretary Gates. He wrote it 2 days ago. And it started by saying the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, MRFF, has learned on numerous occasions over the past several years about blatantly sectarian Christian religious programs and Christian proselytizing in the military. The proselytizing is unconstitutional, and we demand you issue an order to stop it now. And then he goes on with the part that that Gordon just talked about or wrote about. about the shocking incidents. And the other, the part that Gordon didn't include, the letter from Mikey Weinstein, says the following: perhaps the most alarmingly repugnant stories are those coming in from our recent war veterans regarding the widespread practice of, quote, battlefield Christian proselytizing, end quote. When on active duty, our service members sought urgently needed mental health counseling. While on the battlefield, and with the gun smoke practically still in their faces, they were instead sent to evangelizing chaplains, who are apparently being used with increasing frequency to provide so-called mental health care. Due to the actual shortage of mental health professionals, chaplains are not certified professional mental health experts. Duh. The letter to Gates goes on. According to the reports of these veterans, the chaplains they were sent to for evaluation and treatment had the unmitigated temerity to urge, as a medicinal cure, a conversion to evangelical Christianity. And sometimes they went even as far as disgustingly lacing their so-called counseling with the soldiers' need to stay on the battlefield to, quote, kill Muslims for Christ, end quote. Oh, my God. Even in the best cases, while the chaplain's words of proselytizing may have provided a temporary placebo, allowing these soldiers to turn temporarily to combat for the remainder of their deployment, within months of returning home from war, their temporary religious faith, quote unquote, wore off as their profound mental health symptoms, quite predictably, returned in all their fury. And again, the shortage of available mental health care professionals and lack of treatment exacerbated the service members' psychological trauma. Do you understand, Truth Seeker, what's being said here? I mean, I was aware that the Air Force Academy in particular, although they claim to have stopped now, had become nothing more and nothing less than a huge cesspool of Christian proselytizing, and not Christianity as per the teachings of Jesus. It has nothing whatsoever to do with Jesus. Whether you believe Jesus walked the earth or not, whether you believe it was divine or not, that's really, frankly, your business and none of mine. But I've read enough of the Bible and enough of the teachings of Jesus, the at least as laid out by his disciples, to understand fully that he was not a warmongering bastard like these people are trying to tell the soldiers. Well, Jesus wants you to go kill Muslims for Christ. I mean, this is... Okay, calm down. Back to the letter from Mikey Weinstein. We'll cover it. We'll give you some more of this in a moment, as soon as we come back from this break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Well, I'm standing by a river, but the water doesn't flow. It boils with every poison you can think of.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware.
He's a liberal with a microphone, and that makes him dangerous. It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. So let me tell you very quickly about a guy who not only does he listen to the program and is a podcast subscriber, he's also a candidate for the U.S. Senate from Arkansas. His name is John Gray. He is the Arkansas Green Party candidate for Senate. He's a retired engineer, and he's currently serving as the mayor of Greenland, Arkansas. Let me tell you a little bit about the main planks in his platform. National self-sufficiency. Now, that should appeal to just damn near everybody. As a self-sufficiency, huh? Who among us doesn't find that to be a respectable goal? The way John describes it, everything we need for domestic and national security should be produced in American-owned plants in the USA by companies headquartered here. Ah! And I might add, take a little liberty here, they also should be forced, or expected is a better word, to pay taxes on their profits. John also believes in Medicare for all. He describes that, a full-service health care to meet physical, dental, vision, and psychiatric needs of every American, one service for all, including those elected to government office. No! That means everybody has the same access to the same health care? Wow. Restore the traditional tariff system. Now, I like this one. Don't let your eyes glaze over, okay? The tariff system, where we charge companies that make things and send them here. The tariff system, which served the United States of America well until the time of Ronald Reagan, made us the strongest, richest creditor nation on Earth. For over 200 years, globalization made us the greatest debtor nation in the world. Now, again, who's responsible for NAFTA? Bush, Clinton, Bush. Or Bush, Clinton. His next point, end corporate personhood. Oh, eek! You mean they're not really people, John? Corporations claim the same constitutional rights as you do, or I do, allowing for questionable, if not immoral, business practice. You know, when I hear all these right-wing pundits talk about immorality, there it is. That's immorality. John also says enforce antitrust laws, which means corporations too big to fail are too big to exist. Oh, God, isn't that true? And resource wars. Resource wars. Have you ever heard that expression before? Resource wars? The golden rule says we should treat other countries as we would have them treat us. The practice of destabilizing foreign governments for corporate interests should be relegated to the history books, not continue as ongoing policy. My God. John, you are just radical as hell. I mean, where do you get off saying that you want Medicare for all, national self-sufficiency, and corporate personhood? Where does that come from?
Gosh, I guess I've been reading too much of the thought of our founding fathers.
I think you have. We have a break coming pretty quick. I want you to stay over for a few minutes, obviously, to chat. But one of the reasons John got in touch with us here, he is the Green Party candidate for U.S. Senate Arkansas. He's opposing Blanche Lincoln and John Bozeman, who is her strongest opposition. Trevor Down, the Tea Party candidate, made it onto the ballot for November. But John is being excluded from the first state organization of counties debate that's going to occur in Hot Springs, Arkansas tomorrow, Friday, at the convention center there. The question is, why is he not on the ticket? The Tea Party, the Greens, have agreed to jointly protest the rules that allow that, especially at state expense. It's my understanding this debate is paid for by state, which means taxpayer money. Is that right, John?
That's true. It's the Association of Arkansas Counties. It's a taxpayer-funded group.
Which raises the question, after you have gone through the hoops necessary to get on the ballot, why you are being denied a chance to present your views in this forum. And we'll talk about that when we come back. Let me put you on hold, John.
Sure.
We'll come back right after this break. And we want to chat with John Gray. Yes, he's got a website. It's John Gray, G-R-A-Y, John Gray for U.S. Senate. com. John Gray, G-R-A-Y, for U.S. Senate.com. Now, you all know that I do not have guests, hardly ever. Very seldom do I have people who are running for political office. The only time I put people on who are running for political office is when I think that, and this is just, you know, just me. I mean, it is the Mike Malloy show, so I get to do this. When I think that their election would serve this country, everybody in this country, and would serve the country well. So stick around. When we come back, we're going to talk with John Gray, Green Party candidate for Senate from the state of Arkansas. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Liberal helping of truth, it's more Mike Malloy.
It's about 25 before the hour. We have invited to chat for a while John Gray, who is a Green Party candidate for the Senate in the state of Arkansas. John, to the best of your knowledge, why have you been excluded from this debate?
Well, some of my people called over to the organization that's holding the debate to ask about that. And basically, they're going to be talking about economic issues of special interest to the state that supposedly Senator Lincoln and John Bozeman are very familiar with. And besides, their rules don't permit people who whose parties haven't garnered 5% or better of the vote in the past to participate. And so our basic stance has become, since we don't have the lawyers to really legally challenge it or anything, our basic stance has been that anybody who goes out and gathers 10,000 certified signatures to get on the ballot has established their credentials in that the process of gathering these signatures, you only do a small sampling of the state, but if you get 10,000 certified signatures, it's an indicator that the people of the state would like to hear what you have to say.
Right.
And our stance is that all candidates who have gotten themselves on the ballot should be heard by the people of Arkansas in order to have a fair hearing of ideas that are out there for the people to vote on.
This is one of the reasons that the two-party system has such a death grip on our political system in this country. That little rule in so many states, you have to have garnered 5% of the popular vote in past elections. Talk about a catch-22. What if it's your first time? Your first,
precisely.
You know? Oh, my God. So the multiplicity of political parties is practically guaranteed not to be allowed to happen. And I can certainly understand when you consider that the Democrats and the Republicans really do feel that the political system is theirs and any interlopers can go someplace else.
Precisely. I think this particular debate is fascinating because they're concerned about how to improve the economic conditions of Arkansas. And the two people speaking have together voted for more legislation, which has resulted in shipping jobs out of the state than any people I can imagine. They can account their free trade, and there is no difference between them on their free trade votes, have resulted in tens of thousands of jobs being shipped out of the state. And Mr. Bozeman, who I'm sure is a very fine fellow, put in an international trade association up in Bentonville, And one of the things that caught my attention, and typical of the work they do, we had a gentleman here in Arkansas who manufactured caskets. Well, through that organization, he now is going to buy the caskets in China and have them shipped here. And still, and I thought, you know, that's kind of interesting when you can take something so bulky and so big and build it for such little labor that you can ship it here and still be less than paying an Arkansas worker $10 or $12 an hour.
Not to mention the kind of creepiness, you know, of burying someone in a casket not even made in the United States. Not that I particularly care. My will calls for cremation. But thinking about this, thinking that, oh, my God, a casket, a coffin, it has to be built somewhere else. There are no workers in Arkansas who can. It's madness, John. I swear to God, it's madness.
I think so, but this International Trade Center has become, in my opinion, a conduit of jobs out of mm-hmm. Arkansas. So I found it interesting that this organization is having the two, what I would call neoliberal Milton Friedman mm-hmm. thinkers, who have been responsible for the loss of many jobs, discussing how to make things better in the state without hearing people like Trevor Drowns, the Independent, and myself, who have very different views on how to go mm-hmm. about things. I think the people of Arkansas deserve to hear all the ideas out there.
You know, I've tried to puzzle out the answer to this question, as I think Mark Twain would put it, many times. I've asked politicians, or not politicians, I've asked people who seek elective office in order to change the system. And I'm just wondering, what is it about the voters of anywhere, I'm not going to pick on Arkansas because this is true all over the country, that they would consistently elect or re-elect, and the re-elect is the terrible part, people who do that, who send jobs out of the country, who pay more attention to corporate sponsors rather than the people whom they're supposed to represent. Why do voters keep sending those people back into office, John, not just Arkansas, all over the country?
Well, that's a fascinating question. Since my retirement, I have often asked myself the question, why is it I keep running into very intelligent people here in the state of Arkansas, and yet we're at the bottom of any list you want to name? And I think it has occurred to me, I've watched things fairly closely here, that we have such a propaganda machine that people can be convinced that black is white and up is down. It's, the AM airwaves are full of the right-wing talkers. Mm-hmm. There is no liberal programming up here at all, either on TV or on the radio, unless you have satellite radio. Mm-hmm. And I have noticed that polls that are run in the state are more a measure of how effective is the recent propaganda rather than what are actually the people's opinions. It's a reflection of how effective is the propaganda. Mm-hmm. And so people reflect what they are hearing through all of their media and the newspapers are consistently right-wing. Letters to the editor are consistently right-wing. It's an amazing thing. But I think it is a function of the pervasiveness of the propaganda machine here.
Mm-hmm. It is saddening. I'm trying to find a word to understand that that's the reason people consistently vote against their own best interests, their own best economic interests, and in so many other instances, their own best interests where it concerns civil liberties or rights guaranteed by the Constitution. I just can't get past that. And I agree with you that propaganda, right-wing propaganda in this country has been highly effective. It's like propaganda in any society. You know, you can use any of the models that you want, that we use to show how negative propaganda be, whether it's our adversaries during World War II or the North Koreans or you know, pick anybody. But we, too, I mean, we have our media And the people who are most prominent in our media, especially talk radio, as you point out, have learned how to use that propaganda in a way that I think would make Joseph Goebbels just absolutely livid with jealousy. And it's a shame.
Well, it is a shame, and it goes even further than that. I had an opportunity to attend a mega church up in the Springdale Rogers area a year or so ago.
Mm-hmm.
Had 2,000 people in there. It was a celebration of militarism. It was on a Memorial Day weekend, and I was invited by one of my council members to go to church with them there. And the preacher at that went through this thing from the beginning of the United States, and they had soldiers and dress from the period and everything. And he recounted the history of the United States, and such a thorough misunderstanding of the history of this country I've never heard in my life. These people were enthralled with all of this, and I have never seen such a poster for the beauties and wonders of war as mm-hmm. that particular presentation. Mm-hmm. There were 2,000 people in that room. This particular preacher has another church not 10 miles away that he has a second meeting on Sunday mornings, and he is said to commute between the two in his personal helicopter. In that church, mm-hmm. I did not see a lot of poor people, people in rags, or ladies, giving their last three pennies, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I'm saying that this is an extension of the propaganda machine. This place is eaten alive with churches up here. Not that I'm opposed to churches, but my goodness.
Mm. You know, second reference to Mark Twain today, I don't know why it's on my mind, but you may have read one of his more famous or infamous writings called The War Prayer.
War Prayer is wonderful. I put that on the internet the other day.
Yeah, and every time I hear a story like what you just said, I'm just inclined to copy that and get it into the hands of that preacher, whoever the preacher is. I mean, you know, you live in Arkansas. I live in the buckle of the Bible Belt. So, you know, mega churches here in Georgia, we have the mega churches. We also have the little cabins where they still, you know, handle snakes. So we've got the whole spectrum of religious craziness here in the state of Georgia. Can I put you on hold again, John?
Yes, certainly.
Because I want to talk some more with you. We'll take a break and come right back. We're talking with John Gray, who's running for the Senate on the Green Party. Go to his website, if you would, johngrayforussenate.com.
Nobody knew from time to time if the plans were changed. If the plans were changed.
Tell me about it. No more Mr. Nice Guy. Here's Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour, we're talking with John Gray, who is running for the United States Senate in Arkansas on the Green Party ticket and has been denied participation in a debate sponsored by the State Organization of Counties, an organization funded by public money. And the debate will occur in Hot Springs, Arkansas tomorrow at the Convention Center. Starting at 9 a.m., and John is suggesting that folks might want to come down. I want to ask you this, John. I got an email here from a listener who says, regarding you're being denied access to this debate, but you're on the ballot. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. The question is, if the test to qualify as a candidate were simply to collect signatures, what would keep the teabaggers or some other group of screamers from simply lining up the signatures for multiple candidates and overwhelming any debate? That's a fair question.
That's a fair question. I I would think, well, this Trevor Drowns has some Tea Party people behind him, mm-hmm. but he represents the thought of a lot of people, and so, you know, I think the people of Arkansas deserve to hear him as well. I'm saying that it is difficult to get on the ballot in Arkansas. Any group that can put together the forces to get on the ballot, there must be enough people that want to hear them mm-hmm. to make it valid to hear them.
So someone who would say, look, the earth is really flat and everybody's been lying to you, elect me so I can explain that the earth is flat. That type of person would not garner the support necessary to get him or her on the ballot.
That's true. Wouldn't garner the support to get on the ballot. But even so, if you had someone who was a true flake who made it into one of these debates, the Arkansas people that I'm aware of are smart enough to sort these people out very quickly, and I think the general consensus is they had rather do the sorting than have the news media sort for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, like I said, the question is fair, and I can understand where it comes from. On the other hand, the Green Party is not exactly flat earthers. The Green Party has established itself over the years, and not just here, but on just about every continent on Earth, especially in Europe, where Green Party members have held cabinet positions or minister positions in various governments. And it just seems to me that the Green Party can't, no matter what it tries to do here, in so many instances can't qualify either to get the signatures to get on the ballot, A, or B, participate in debates. And it's a very effective way to choke this stuff off. What are you going to do, John, if are you going to show up for the debate and ask to be included?
No, we're going to be out in front. Trevor Drowns people and ours have agreed to demonstrate in favor of opening the debates to all people on the ballot in all venues, all debates. Mm-hmm. That's only fair to the people of Arkansas.
That makes sense. All people on the ballot get a chance to state their views. How is your campaign coming? Do people understand? Are people getting the word about what you advocate?
Well, it seems to be going viral on the internet. I am amazed at the support that's kind of coming out of the ether, as it were. I have a very fine campaign team that has formed, again, from all parts of the state. In fact, it's such that it really doesn't even make sense to have an office anywhere because the drivers of my campaign are so far flung across the state. But they're very smart people and very dedicated to making things better in the state. And I'm just proud to be a part of it. I got to be involved in this because some of my activities as mayor caught the attention of the head of the Green Party who lives up in this part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And he invited me to start coming to some of their meetings, and I guess they liked what I had to say and that sort of thing, and eventually asked me to do this. And the initial thought was they wanted to change the image of the Green Party from, you know, liberal, pot-smoking, tree-hugging, sandal-wearing hippies to more business look, you know, businessman look.
Right.
And I thought, you know, that alone is a worthy goal, and I thought maybe I could convince a few voters to vote in their own interest, and at first I wouldn't have given much of a chance at all of my chances of ever prevailing. But when I see how people are so discouraged and disgusted with the way with the incumbents across the country, and especially here in Arkansas, and just the way things are going, and the fact that John Bozeman is in the polls predicted to outdo Blanche Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
But my observation is the person with the biggest bucket of money usually prevails. And so I'm sure by the time the election rolls around that Blanche Lincoln is going to be the best thing since sliced bread.
Mm-hmm.
But I still have this faint hope someplace down deep that when people understand what the issues are, that votes and people and their attitudes will carry more value than money. You know, it's kind of like belief in the original American system and hope that it's not dead.
Mm. Well, John, I wish you the best. I wish there were more candidates like you. This has got to be an awful big difference from serving as mayor of Greenland, Arkansas, or running for Senate in the entire state. But I wish you the best. And please stay in touch with us. It's John Gray for USSenate.com. The last name is G-R-A-Y. Thanks for taking the time this morning, John.
Well, I appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Good luck.
Thank you.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Did I say thank you for taking time this morning? Well, how could that be? It's evening. It's today. It is Thursday, and all there is today, now, as Kathy keeps chirping in my ears. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. It is 7 past the hour on the Malloy program. Go to that guy's website, would you? John Gray for USSenate.com. Interesting piece from Bloomberg.com. The business website, one might say. And a piece written by Lawrence Kotlikoff, who is, what does old Lawrence do? Lawrence is a professor of economics at Boston University. And he is the author of the book, Jimmy Stewart is Dead, Ending the World's Ongoing Financial Plague with Limited Purpose Banking. I guess that's reference to, what's the Christmas movie?
Wonderful Life.
That was Jimmy Stewart, wasn't it? Yeah. How could I not remember Wonderful Life? Anyway, I want to share this with you. Kotlikoff says, let's get real. The U.S. is bankrupt. Neither spending more nor taxing less will help the country pay its bills. Spending more, let me digress, is what I recommend, and I'm not an economist. Taxing less is what the psychopaths, the sociopaths in the society recommend. Anyway, Kotlikoff says what the United States must do and can do is radically simplify its tax, health care, retirement, and financial systems, each of which is a complete mess. I digress. Yeah, well, that's what I've been talking about now ever since I came up with Malloy Socialism, Malloy's Democratic Socialism, although I didn't have retirement in there to be federalized. Anyway, he says, but this is the good news. It means that each of these categories, tax, healthcare, retirement, financial systems, can be redesigned to achieve their legitimate purposes. at much lower cost and in the process revitalize the economy. Oh, really? Damn! Revitalize the economy and get things working again. What a great idea. That means it'll never happen. But this is the scary part. Kolakoff writes that last month, the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, released its annual review of U.S. economic policy. Its summary contained these bland words about U.S. fiscal policy. Here you go. Quote, directors welcomed the authority's commitment to fiscal stabilization, but noted that a larger-than-budgeted adjustment would be required to stabilize debt to gross domestic product, end quote. Now, you and I read that, and we go, what? Never mind. Give me a cup of coffee. If we would read that at all. But if you go deeper, according to Kolakoff, you'll find that the IMF has effectively pronounced the U.S. bankrupt. Now, the International Monetary Fund, right, they're the ones that are very instrumental in destabilizing as a result of the destabilizing, causing governments to be overthrown, revolutions to occur, bloodbaths to take place. International Monetary Fund, they can destroy a country just by issuing a report like this. Uh-oh! But if you go deeper, you'll find that the IMF has effectively pronounced U.S. bankrupt. Section 6 of this report that came out in July says, quote, the U.S. fiscal gap associated with today's federal fiscal policy is huge for plausible discount rates. What does that mean? It adds that, quote, closing the gap requires a permanent annual fiscal adjustment equal to about 14% of U.S. gross domestic product, end quote. What does that mean? I don't know if I read that. Would you know what that means? Maybe Bruce Enberg would know, but who knows? What does that mean? Yeah? The fiscal gap is the value today, the present value, of the difference between projected spending, including servicing the interest on our debt, and revenue in all future years. You get it? It's the difference. The fiscal gap is how much we're going to spend and how much we're going to collect. We being the United States of America. So that's called the fiscal gap. You got it? That's easy. Hey, I got that one. I got that one, Kathy. God, I got that. Ah! To put 14% of gross domestic product in perspective, because that's what it says, in order to close the fiscal gap, that would require a permanent annual fiscal adjustment equal to about 14% of U.S. GDP. You got it? They're using words like permanent, forever, all future years. These are not qualified statements. These are pretty damn definite. Okay. To put 14% of gross domestic product in perspective, current federal revenue totals 14.9% of gross domestic product. Everything that the government takes in equals less than 15% of everything that we produce. Oh, but I thought we were being taxed, unbelievably taxed. Well, that's what the teabaggers say. So the IMF is saying that closing the U.S. fiscal gap from the revenue side, trying to bring in more money, requires, roughly speaking, an immediate and permanent doubling of our personal income, corporate and federal taxes, as well as the payroll levy set down in the Federal Insurance Contribution Act. Ah! What? Oh, my God. Such a tax hike would leave the United States running a surplus equal to 5% of GDP this year rather than a 9% deficit. So the IMF is really saying the U.S. needs to run a huge surplus now and for many years to come to pay for the spending that is scheduled. It is also saying the longer the country wants to make tough fiscal adjustments, waits to make tough fiscal adjustments, the more painful they will be. Okay. So the IMF, that famous or infamous, depending on your point of view, transnational, I guess, agency, like the World Bank, that decides who lives, who dies, who eats, who serves, who sleeps, who stands guard, the IMF, what governments will stay in place, what governments will be destroyed, what financial systems will win, which will lose. IMF, International Monetary Fund. Woo! They're saying that taxes in this country, personal taxes, income taxes, corporate taxes, everything, has to be doubled forever. Wow. So, Gottlikoff asks, is the IMF bonkers? I mean, this is United States. We are already convincing ourselves that we are the most overtaxed population in the history of the human race. This is what the baggers and freak asses like Beck and Limbaugh and the rest of these pigs are constantly saying. Oh, taxes, taxes! Ah, ah! And yet, we are paying the lowest percentage of our incomes in taxes ever. Ever! But as we were talking with our guest, this is how effective this Nazi propaganda has been in this country. This is why Limbaugh makes $50 million a year. This is why Beck makes $30 million a year. This is why Hannity tries to tell everybody he makes $15 million a year. This is why these guys, these right-wing freaks, are paid such big money. To keep the truth from you! And by God, don't they do a good job, huh? Son of a bitch, don't they do a good job? Ah, but there's more for Mr. Kotlikoff. Stay there.
And I like the banks of the Mississippi River. And I like banks of Fender Twin Reverb. Well, we don't want them to treat me like a dog, only hit them in the head with the voodoo law. Republicans, one and all. Steal from the poor and to give to the rich. Gonna make the bank president twitch in a ditch.
Oh. Better, but I don't mind. You just kind of wasted my precious time.
Flying monkey right. It's Mike Malone.
At Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens.
21 past the hour. Yeah, we could sit here and listen to Leonard Cohen. Or it could go back to the fun and frivolity of this program. We're talking about here a column at Bloomberg.com, an opinion piece by Lawrence Gottlikoff, who is a professor of economics at Boston University, who is letting us know that the International Monetary Fund released a report about a month ago that says the United States is bankrupt and essentially bankrupt, and there's no way out of this. Lowering taxes will do nothing. Increasing spending will do nothing. So what has to be done, according to the IMF, to close that fiscal gap is a doubling of U.S. taxes in terms of percentage of gross domestic product. They have to be doubled. Current federal revenues total 14.9% of GDP, according to this report. So the IMF is saying that closing that gap would require that personal taxes, income, corporate, federal taxes, as well as the payroll levy set down by the Federal Insurance Contribution Act, payroll taxes, everything, an immediate and permanent doubling of taxes in order to survive. Huh? So he asks, is the IMF bonkers? And the answer is no. It's done its homework. So has the Congressional Budget Office, whose report, Long-Term Budget Outlook, released in June, shows an even larger problem. Now, in the meantime, what the hell is going on in the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House? What's going on in the Obama administration? Are they paying attention to this? No. Lawrence Kotlikoff goes on. Based on the Congressional Budget Office's data in that long-term budget outlook report, I, Kotlikoff, calculate a fiscal gap of $202 trillion. That's $202,000 billion. Which, Kotlikoff says, is more than 15 times the official debt. This gargantuan discrepancy between our official debt and our actual net indebtedness isn't surprising. It reflects what economists call the labeling problem. Congress, you see, has been very careful over the years to label most of its liabilities unofficial to keep them off the books and far into the future. For example, our Social Security FICA contributions are called taxes, and our future Social Security benefits are called payments or transfer payments. The government could equally well have labeled our contributions loans, our contributions into the Social Security system, and our future benefits repayment of those loans, less an old age tax, with the old age tax making up for any differences between the benefits promised and principal plus interest on the contributions. Do you get that? The fiscal gap, the real fiscal gap, isn't affected by this labeling. It's the only theoretically correct measure of our long-term fiscal condition because it considers all spending, no matter how it's labeled. Off budget, unofficial, emergency, that's hogsnot. All spending, no matter how it's labeled. In other words, it requires an honest assessment. So how can this fiscal gap be so enormous? $202 trillion. There's not that much money in the known or the unexplored universe. $202 trillion? No. Our indebtedness is only, what is it? $14 trillion. $14 trillion. $14 trillion. No, it isn't. It's 15 times that. Now I understand why Prairie 2's reports to this program are always so hideously negative. He knew. $202 trillion. Now, once you get to that level, of course, you're into quantum physics, where nothing is what it really is, seems. It changes just by observing it, and this flies over there, and this goes there, and nothing is real. I understand that. $202 trillion as a number, as a function of something that we are supposed to do, something that we're supposed to solve, is asinine. $202 trillion, you and I can't even conceive of $1 trillion on any level, in any regard. But $202 trillion in terms of a fiscal gap? No. I don't think so. How can that gap be so enormous? Lawrence is going to explain it to us when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Loud, proud, progressive talk.
it's Mike Malloy.
It is 25 before the hour. We are quoting here extensively from a piece at BloombergNews.com, an opinion piece written by Lawrence Kotlikoff. He is a professor of economics at Boston University. And the point he's trying to make here is the International Monetary Fund has said that in order for the United States to survive, taxes, all taxes have to be doubled immediately and made permanent. Doubled immediately. All taxes. Personal income tax, corporate taxes. Of course, you double corporate taxes for most of these people, it's still zero. Most of the corporations that pay 0%, you double it, it's still 0%. But what he means is double taxes as a percentage of gross domestic product. Right now, the income, the revenue that is collected in this country is 14.9%. We have a 14% gap, revenue gap. And none of this makes any sense to me either, except Kotlikoff is doing a very good job of explaining it and scaring the bejesus out of you if you're listening, if you're paying attention to this. So anyway, bottom line, double the taxes as a percentage of gross domestic product, and we might come out of this. And then he says that the fiscal gap, really, forget all the lies and deceit by Democrats and Republicans. Forget it. Forget the smokescreen put up by the propaganda machine that is right-wing media in this country, which is 95% of all media. Forget all of it. The real debt that this country is facing is $202 trillion, the fiscal gap. And then he asks the question, how can the gap be so enormous? Simple. Simple, he says. Simple. We have 78 million baby boomers who, when fully retired, will collect benefits from Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid that on average exceed per capita gross domestic product. The annual cost of these entitlements will total about $4 trillion in today's dollars. Yes, our economy will be bigger in 20 years, but not big enough to handle the size load year after year. This is what happens when you run a massive Ponzi scheme, he says, for six decades straight, taking ever larger resources from the young and giving them to the old while promising the young that their eventual return, it'll be their turn at getting some of this generational passing of the buck. Herb Stein, chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors under Richard Nixon, coined an oft-repeated phrase, which is, quote, something that can't go on will stop, end quote. Did that go by too fast? Something that can't go on will stop. But what we're talking about here, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all this retirement stuff, it will stop too late. And then, Kotlikoff says, it will stop in a very nasty manner. The first possibility is massive benefit cuts visited on the baby boomers in retirement. The second is astronomical tax increases that leave the young with little incentive to work and save. And the third is the government simply printing vast quantities of money to cover its bills. Most likely, Kotlikoff says, we will see a combination of all three responses with dramatic increases in poverty, tax, interest rates, and consumer prices. This is an awful downhill road to follow, but it's the one we are on. And the bond traders will kick us miles down our own road once they wake up and realize the United States is in worse fiscal shape than Greece. Some doctrinaire Keynesian economists would say any stimulus over the next few years won't affect our ability to deal with deficits in the long run. This is wrong. As a simple matter of arithmetic, the fiscal gap is the government's credit card bill, and each year's 14% of GDP is the interest on that bill. If it doesn't pay this year's interest, it will be added to the balance. It just keeps going on. Demand siders say foregoing this year's 14% fiscal tightening and spending even more will pay for itself in percent in present value. by expanding the economy and tax revenue. My reaction? Get real. Or go hang out with the equally deluded supply-siders. Our country is broke and can no longer afford no pain, all gain, so-called solutions. So there you have it. Lawrence Kotlikoff, who's a professor of economics at Boston University, making it very clear what has to be done. A massive tax increase. And you know what? You don't have to be a professor at Boston University to come to that conclusion. You really don't. I mean, those of us who have high school diplomas and a little college can figure that one out. We can. Which all boils down to one of the reasons that you hear me get so pissed off on this program every single night. Just furious. Just absolutely out of my skull. Screaming, yelling, using bad language. Getting emails from general managers and program directors of radio stations saying, you've got to chill out a bit with the language, Beloy. This is, you know, this is why. This is where it comes from. Because I know, and surely you know, that the chances that we will, our leadership, will take a look at this report and take a look at what's coming from the Congressional Budget Office and take a look at everything fiscally connected in this society and say, okay, here's what we're going to have to do to survive. Here's what we're going to have to do. Sorry, folks, but we're going to have to tax ourselves. We're going to have to double our taxes as a function of gross domestic product. It's going to be rough, but everybody will continue. We'll have jobs. Everybody will continue to make money. But we must have an increase in taxes. You know that's going to happen on the very same day. As a matter of fact, the very same hour that somebody opens an ice cream franchise on the lowest level of hell. In other words, since hell is non-existent, it means it's not going to happen. So hold on to your ass and other parts of your body. Prairie 2 has been advising you on this program for a couple of years now to put away canned goods. And when the expiration date comes and everything hasn't collapsed, give it to your local food bank, because the local food bank will get it in the hands of people who need it. They'll eat it immediately before it does expire, and then you go buy more. And everybody's been kind of going, oh, guffaw, guffaw. Oh, Prairie 2, another one of those Malloy program nutcases. Buy canned goods. Oh, Jesus. Yeah, okay. Guess what? I love the sound that a clicking pen makes, don't you? Guess what? I think old Prairie 2 is right. $202 trillion in debt. That's not even a number. You know, some people say, well, that's just a number. No, it's not even a number. That is something from, I don't know. It's not even from the realm of quantum mechanics or quantum physics or theoretical particle physics or wormholes or string theory. It's so far beyond that stuff. In terms of comprehensibility, don't you agree? $202 trillion. How about just $1 trillion? That's a fifth of a way to quadrillion. Now there's a number that'll kick your ass. Quadrillion, and then there's quintillion, and then sextillion, and then septillion, octillion, nonillion, and finally you get decillion. Of course, that's why we have logarithms. $202 trillion. All right. We have a break coming. When we come back, we'll take some phone calls. You want to call in? The number is 877-996-2556. Oh, there are callers on hold. We'll get to you as soon as we can. 877-996-2556. And we're going to move on now away from things fiscal because all of a sudden my head hurts. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Hey, truth seekers, gather round the campfire. It's more Mike Malloy.
It's about 9 before the hour. Did you hear about the 5-year-old boy in Chicago who shot and killed his twin brother while playing cops and robbers with his teenage cousin's gun? Stephen in Hammond, Indiana sends us in. Just think, if only that 5-year-old's twin brother, the one that's now dead, had had a gun. He could have shot and killed the first kid before the first kid shot and killed him. If it just wasn't for those damn liberals and their disrespect for the Second Amendment, what is wrong with a 5-year-old carrying a gun? Sometimes a 5-year-old has to defend himself against, in this instance, his twin 5-year-old brother. When guns are outlawed, 5-year-olds won't be able to carry a gun. Okay. I knew this would happen. From Prairie 2, our economic affairs advisor, he says, Professor Larry Kotlikoff is full of crap. The guy was just quoting from, the debt comes from the fact that they have done away with production. They being, you know, the capitalist corporate overlords, and they are buying the production from the transnational corporations on credit. The only reason anybody has dollars to lend the United States is that the government has not been collecting the money in taxes. It's that nonsense that has to stop. The $200 trillion deficit or budget gap is not a real number, Prairie 2 writes, but a pointless extrapolation. But they're going to use it to get what they want. The end of the middle class. The money supply can be restructured to fix this problem, but it has to be hand in hand with rebuilding America. Literally, he means rebuilding America, the corporate or the manufacturing infrastructure, and everything else that constitutes the infrastructure of this country. Prairie 2 also says the solution that the International Monetary Fund always proposes for any country that they get their claws into is to get rid of the middle class, and to forbid the holding of any wealth by anybody but transnational corporations. Doubling taxes across the board would accomplish that goal. You'll see calls for selling off the commons, roads, bridges, dams, everything, to eliminate costs, quote, quote. They don't mention that you could dramatically increase gross domestic product by increasing the income of the working poor. And the trade deficit is subtracted from the GDP. Besides imports create a negative multiplier throughout the country. Imports do. Exports is what we need, you see. But we don't make anything here anymore. So we've got imports. Then there is the interest on the debt, pray to, right? So Obama is budgeting $500 billion to pay that. But if interest goes up, that could easily balloon to $1 trillion or more. It's all just a paper game to hide the real damage from 30 years of Reaganomics. No manufacturing means no middle class, but you can still have a hell of an upper class. And the people who run the International Monetary Fund happen to be from the upper class. Ta-da! Well, thanks, Prairie 2. That article was giving me a headache and making my stomach upset. So I'm very glad to hear that it's all hog's nut. Yes, indeed. Nora is in Minnesota, listening on KTNF. Hey, Nora.
Hey there, Mike. It's really exciting to talk to you in the morning.
Well, it's not morning. This is evening. Now, what did you really call about?
I called about the bright spot over here. Our candidate for governor that we just figured out yesterday. He's Mark Dayton, the former senator who was on the team with Paul Wellstone when all the terrible things happened with the plane crash.
Right.
And then now he's he spent $3 million to become the candidate against the DFL party, but he's an extremist in the way of rich men, because he's a humble rich man with a heart and a conscience. He was like volunteering in the 60s and 70s. I'm sure he was very much influenced by Bob Dylan. And now he says we have to raise all the taxes of everybody over approximately $173,000 for a couple, or $130,000, I think, approximately for a single person.
Okay, wait. Now, Mark Dayton is a Democrat, right?
Yes, he won the Democratic primary.
And he's not the...
he wasn't the endorsed candidate,
Of the DFL.
Of the DFL. That was Margaret Anderson Kelleher, and she lost by 7,000 votes.
Now, why is Mark Dayton better than the DFL candidate?
Well, he's 7,000 votes better.
Yeah, I understand that. I understand he won. But why is he a better leader for, or you say, governor?
He's willing to take a more radical stand against not raising taxes on the rich people. In other words, he says the rich people must and absolutely must be raised. And they had an argument in the last debate because it was sort of like a total love fest at the debate. So she kind of like felt, I think, that she had to disagree on something. And she said that if a nurse was married to a policeman, well, their taxes would be raised now, and that wouldn't be good. And he said, well, Margaret, that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Because they would be approximately $130,000 or whatever, and they would have to be $172,000 to have mm-hmm. their taxes raised.
All right. Well, I'm glad to hear this, Nora. I think, sadly, I have not followed Mark Dayton that much. But during this break, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to look him up. Thanks, Margaret. We'll be right back, everybody. Stay with us. Pony. Welcome back. 7 past the hour. This is the Molloy program. Mark Dayton, I don't know if Nora knows stuff I don't know about the insider political stuff in Minnesota. I'm sure she does. What do I mean I don't know? Of course she does. She lives there. Mark Dayton, though, this was a Democratic primary, of course, and according to what I have here from Politico.com, Mark Dayton is a DFL candidate, like most of them are DFL candidates. Dayton is an heir to the department store fortune, Dayton's department stores. That also includes the Target chain. So let's see what's going to happen. If Mark Dayton does become governor of Minnesota, and this other guy, Emmer, who is, he's running, is he running for governor or is he running for Senate? Governor? Emmer is the right. Yeah, the right-wing Nazi. So we have, and but they're both have a connection to Target. I mean, think about that for a second. Both of the candidates, I guess both. I don't know. Somebody send me an email if I'm wrong. I'm probably wrong. But isn't the guy who is the homophobe, right-wing nutball, neo-Nazi or proto-Nazi, whatever the hell he is, I don't know. I'm great at name-calling, and if you don't like it, switch to a different program. He's a Nazi. He, is he running for governor? Emmer? Okay, I guess he is. And now Dayton is running for governor on the other side, and they both have connections through Target. that's how corporate America wants it. They want to control the candidates or have a connection to the candidates or have the candidates control them on both sides. Brian is in Manchester, New Hampshire. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike. Yeah, I was just... Hello?
Yes, yes, hello.
How are you? I was just listening to your rebroadcast last night. That Neil Bortz there, I'd like to see him try to get in line without any private security with those 30,000 people there looking for the 400 housing vouchers and just to get an application for them and just standing out there for 3 days. I'd like to see him use his rough language with those people there in person there without any private security protection.
Well, they would strip his flesh off his bones because everybody in Atlanta and hopefully everybody around the country understands that Neil Bortz is without doubt the most racist right-wing talk show host on the air. There are others who are more anti-Arab or anti-Jewish or anti-this or anti-that, but Neil Bortz is the single most racist anti-black white man on radio. And yeah, they would, and the people who are down there know who he is. They would have stripped his flesh off down to the bone, let him run around in his skeleton.
And I'm hoping also that caller Nora from Minnesota, I hope she's right about former Senator Dayton there, that he's a good man. There was a good man, a good rich man, too, named Al, who actually won the 2000 election, had the Social Security lockbox idea that he was fully ready to implement after the three last years of Clinton where American government ran budget surpluses without having a penny of the American workers' Social Security annual surplus amounts. And Al Gore's lockbox would have come in place if it hadn't been for that 2000 stolen election. I think he would have prevented the 9/11 attacks, too. But I want to talk about the sense of entitlement, too. I think you're right on about the Department of Offense, mm-hmm. the Pentagon. I believe it does need to be dismantled or hugely downsized.
Downsized.
You know, but there's a sense of entitlement that the right-wingers have there. There's a former... Karen Kwiatkowski now, if you've ever seen a documentary, Hijacking Catastrophe, she served well and honorably in the U.S. Air Force and as an officer in the Pentagon. And she's now a Randian libertarian in some sense, and I can't understand her. She knows that the history is out there about Alan Greenspan, her fellow libertarian. He created the largest tax increase in history under Ronald Reagan, the Social Security payroll tax increases from 1980s onward. But now she wants to say she's a different kind of libertarian that stands for something different. But she still has a sense of entitlement that all military veterans like herself, and I agree she served well and honorably, that they're entitled to their 100% military retirements, but what of the American workers and all the Social Security surpluses and all the monies they've paid in? Are they not entitled to their retirement amounts as well?
Well, you know, I kind of like that for its audacity, Brian. A new kind of libertarian that says she is entitled to a pension, but the average worker is not. That's great. I like that. Brian, thanks. I got to go. Appreciate your call. Okay, not only Prairie 2, but now we have Benedict at large here. Mike, I read that piece you referred to, the economics piece. I was torn as I read between laughing at its stupidity and crying over the knowledge that our economic elite actually believe crap like that. I ended up just ripping it up. Please understand that neither the article's author nor the IMF knows what they're talking about. In other words, they have their head up their donkeys. Their entire understanding of money is bogus and based on a holdover of when we were pegged to gold, which they seem not to have noticed that we've dropped. They want us to believe that the government's checkbook is just like yours, only bigger. Mike, can you print money anytime you want? These folks pretend that this makes no difference. Jerks. In a modern monetary fiat system like us, the federal debt is identified or is identical to the private sector. That's us. Our savings, except that the debt has a minus in front of it, and ours has a plus in front of it, which is very nice. Think of it this way. Every single penny that the government has spent but not taxed back, in other words, the federal debt, is somewhere. And that somewhere is in our wallets and bank accounts, which is also very nice. Further, were we to pay off that debt, quote, quote, we would be left with exactly nothing in our wallets and bank accounts. And that wouldn't be very nice. Further still, the United States can never be bankrupt. How can anyone with a printing press ever run out of money? That's silly. And no, printing money does not cause inflation, as our silly economists claim. I won't go through the gory details, but you should see the hacking that those economists do with their equations in their attempt to fry that omelet. Goodness, a seventh grader in her first year of algebra would recognize it as nonsense.
Well, I missed it.
The good news is that there is a way back to prosperity for us, and it doesn't involve any of this pain nonsense that the sadistic IMF insists is necessary. The bad news, however, is that none of our important economists know what they're doing. And so we are more likely to be sent unnecessarily on a trip through a hell of their making. Benedict at large. Well, thanks, Benedict. You and Prairie 2 have certainly eased my day, even though you insist a seventh grader in her first year of algebra would recognize all this is nonsense, which is a clear indication of my lack of understanding. But that's all right. I never claimed to know everything. Yes, Catherine?
No, I was just reminded of a friend of mine who went to college, and her parents had set her up a checking account, and she overdrew it. And she had two comments on that. She said, well, how can I be overdrawn? I still have checks left. And the other thing she said, her father said, well, look at all the money you spent. And you wrote all these checks. And she said, well, Daddy, I didn't subtract them. Sure, I wrote them. That's what we did. We just didn't subtract them. We wrote them. Subtract them.
I'm glad that both Prairie 2 and Benedict at Large cleared those cobwebs out of my mind. Because for a minute there, the professor from Boston University had me just absolutely terrified. Of course, everybody has me terrified these days, even Prairie 2. But I just want him to know that, yes, I have stocked up on canned goods. I don't know what canned asparagus are going to taste like when everything goes to hell, but they're in there. Let's take a break. We'll be right back. Hey, call in, damn it, 877-996-2556. I'm Mike Malloy. Stay with us.
watches C-SPAN so you don't have to. It's more Mike Malone.
It is 21 past the hour. James writes in about Mark Dayton is a better candidate than Kelleher, the woman against whom he ran. James, right, recall my email regarding former owner Mark Dayton of Target, who ran as a Senate candidate who had worked for Minnesota for $1 a year. He was threatened by Cheney with that line, quote, bad things sometimes happen, end quote. Yeah, I remember that. My opinion, James writes, is that this man has committed class suicide, like George Pillsbury did and Bill Kunstler and Ralph Nader. None of them needed to work for money. And they all explicitly take or took stands, as your guest, Mr. Gray, did this morning. Yeah, that's okay. That's a good point. I'm pretty convinced the political system in this country is fried anyway. But, okay. If there are still people who will take the risk, who will run for office, and they are decent people, sure, why not support them, no matter what their political affiliation is. Now, by saying that, that doesn't mean, oh, Mike would vote for a Republican or a teabagger. No, because the qualifier is if they are people who are dedicated to the idea of improving the quality of life for everybody in this country, A. B, in doing that, in order to do that, re-energizing, revitalizing the United States. I don't care if we're the dog catcher party, but those kind of people don't exist in the Republican Party or this teabag faction of nutballs. They're just not there. There aren't very many of them left in the Democratic Party either. The Green Party, let's hope that they are what the Green Party has always said that they are. I have no reason to doubt them. So anyway. Bill is in Allentown, PA. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Mike.
How are you?
Hey, this is all right. This is strange. 10 o'clock in the morning to 1 o'clock. Well, ten. No, it's like the old hours.
No. You must
but 12 hours earlier, 12 hours later.
You must be in a time warp. It's almost 11. It's almost midnight. What are you talking about?
Yeah, I know. Well, it's after midnight.
Okay. Anyway, the real reason you called
was about the brother that killed his brother. I live in a gun nut state and I come from a gun nut family.
Yeah.
But every once in a while, what I do is this: a couple of weeks ago on my Facebook page, I put down the Second Amendment. I wrote it verbatim from the copy that I have.
Uh-huh.
And then I asked a few questions, like, where does it say that we can't regulate sales? Where does it say that we can't regulate, you know? There was a couple of questions there.
Yeah, I think the amendment use the term well-regulated?
Yeah, it does. And that's what, you know, and the NRA is always talking about, no, I can't regulate anything.
Yeah.
And that's what kind of bothers me. And I hear stories about kids killing, you know, their brothers, and that, you know,
mm-hmm.
that kind of bothers me.
Yeah, it does me too. A 5-year-old that gets a gun and shoots his 5-year-old twin. I don't know how to handle that story. If I were the parents, I would be devastated. I don't know if I could survive.
I don't know either.
The death of a child that young. I make my flip remarks. Well, actually, it was Stephen who sent me the email with the flip remark. But, what else are you going to say? What else are you going to say? I mean, when the NRA goes ahead and holds its convention in Colorado shortly after the mass killings at Columbine, with no respect for the people who might be grieving in that state, what are you going to say? I have never in my life met a bigger bunch of paranoid, crybaby, chicken-dropping freaks than your average NRA member. These people are not about gun ownership. They're about suppressing women and keeping the Negroes down and making the Jews go home and fencing off Zionist organized government and all this other crap, this crazy nonsense, and shooting immigrants and doing that. They're not about gun ownership, responsible gun ownership. If they were about responsible gun ownership, and it's not just NRA, this Gun Owners of America, a group of real crazy people, it's not about gun ownership. It's about suppressing everybody's rights but theirs. That's all it's about. So to hell with these people. Just to hell with them. Bill, thanks. Appreciate you checking in. We have one open line if you want to call in. 877-996-2556. We're going to take a break. And come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun? Wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun?
We wouldn't need the police no more because everybody would have a gun.
Yeah! Wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun? Wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun?
Had a gun!
Wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun?
Had a gun! Nobody'd ever get shot because everybody'd have a gun.
Makes sense! Wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun? Wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun?
We wouldn't need the police no more, because everybody'd have a gun.
Yeah, wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun? Wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun?
Had a gun.
Wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun?
Had a gun. Nobody'd ever get shot, because everybody'd have a gun.
Makes sense. Wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun? We can go out and shoot.
All because of the color of his skin. What do you think about that, my friend? Yes, son, we got met with a tear gas.
25 before the hour.
No, why we come, going back, we come from.
25 before the hour as he chokes to death. Welcome back. Back to some phone calls here. Bill is in Minnesota. Hey, Bill.
Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Looking forward to Saturday. I'm going to be there again.
Oh, you're coming from Minnesota?
Yep. This will be not the fifth time that I haven't met you. So it's great. I never my son works for the airline there. He lives there and just off of Ponce whatever it is. I did my Target thing.
Yeah.
You know because my son's gay and he lives with his partner there.
Uh huh.
And I certainly, as a matter of fact, I used your line. I listened to your podcast on the way over to my local Target store, and I asked the store manager. I said, "Are you schizophrenic?"
Be careful, Bill.
Well, I did not mention your name or anything. But you mean as far as
yeah, I mean walking up to somebody and saying, "Are you schizophrenic?" They might take offense.
No. I meant what I meant to say is your. I didn't explain. I'm the corporation.
Ah, I see.
The corporation.
And what was the answer?
She just a blank stare. I mean, I mean, when you come up with a. Say something like that. What are they going to say? How are they going to respond? You know?
Yeah.
So. But in anyway, I don't know what to say other than I'm looking forward to.
Well, me too. I hope during the meet and greet or whatever, come up and introduce yourself again. I think we've met out there before, right?
Yeah, you were here at the Blue State thing.
Yeah,
I was not able to get. I didn't get a ticket soon enough to get a prime ticket. But I have talked to Bob. I'll be able to meet Bob. I just bought some coffee from him.
Bob Alexander.
Yeah. Oh, he's a wonderful man.
Isn't he? You got some of his coffee?
Oh yeah, it's the greatest.
Oh man, that stuff is really good. As a matter of fact, right here in this very cup, I don't know if you're watching online, is a cup of Bob Alexander's superbeans.com coffee. Mmm.
Yeah, it is.
All right. Now, you said your son lives here in Atlanta.
Yes.
And what's interesting, you said he lives near Ponce.
I was there once.
Well, you know what is fun about this, and we've had to explain to Molly. Here, the name of the street, it's a long street. It goes from the very heart of downtown Atlanta all the way out into the eastern suburbs, probably 25 miles. And the street is named Ponce de Leon, and it's spelled Ponce de Leon, just like the French explorer. But here in Georgia, it's pronounced Ponce de Leon. That's the way they pronounce it, Ponce de Leon. So in order to make sure that we who want to speak proper English or French understand what we're talking about, we just shortened it and call it Ponce. Because if somebody is here, a visitor, and they see the name of the street, it's Ponce de Leon, and they hear people pronouncing it Ponce de Leon, you come across as kind of a real Georgia Yahoo. So we just say Ponce, and everybody in Georgia or in Atlanta who is partially articulate pronounces it Ponce. They just use the first part of it, Ponce. And we've had to explain to Molly, because when Molly started to read, and she started reading everything, we would drive on Ponce de Leon, and she would look at it and say, Ponce D. We say, that's pronounced Ponce de Leon. And she'd say, well, Daddy, they don't pronounce it that way. They pronounce it Ponce de Leon. I said, yeah, but you're no Georgia cracker.
Yeah.
When in fact she really is, I guess she is. But anyway, all that to your son works for Delta, I take it.
Yes. He's a pricing analyst, and had I not had a high paying union job, I'm a tool and die maker by trade, retired. I took the 30-year.
Are there still people who do that? I remember when I was a kid, some of the highest paid union jobs, manufacturing jobs, are tool and die maker. Do we still do that in this country?
No, everything is pretty much laser cut now. So die making is kind of a lost art. You know, just like Tom Hartman's father was a tool and die maker.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I remember that from talking with Tom. So that's what you did. Boy, you talk about a profession from the past, from the 50s and 60s and even into the 70s, right?
Exactly. And then I did make injection, plastic injection molds as well before I retired in 02.
Wow.
And now I draw a union pension and I from the IAM. So I think I better get on. I'm 62. I better get on the Social Security bandwagon like now.
Well, if you do it now, of course you're going to take a reduced, greatly reduced payment. What the hell? Wait a minute. I don't believe the scare stories. I think Social Security is going to be there. If you wait, I guess your cohort doesn't get full benefits until you're what, about 67 and 10 months or 66 and 10 months or something?
My wife?
Uh-huh.
People
in your age group, you said you're 62. You probably don't get full, you could get reduced benefits right now, obviously, but you can't, if you wait, you'll get full benefits, but I think in your age group, you have to wait until you're way past 65.
That may be. I would have to,
Well, you know what they say, Bill, take the money and run to hell with it. Hey, listen, I'll see you in Seattle, all right?
Thanks very much, Mike.
All right, man. Take care. Take care, Bill. Tim is in L.A. Hello, Tim.
Hey, good evening, Mike. How are you?
Just fine.
Great. You know what? I was listening to your show online, of course, and I guess I came to the conclusion that the reason why people, especially Republicans, are so stupid is because no one actually sits down with them and explains to them what's up, because, you know, they hear all these talking heads who are saying, oh, we got to cut taxes, we got to do this, we got to do that to save money, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
But my professor in college, I went back to school to improve myself, and what I did was, you know, was the professor basically came from the same, I guess, material, whatever, as the tax cuts. you know, cut taxes. But then I said, you know, I explained to them that, well, we need to increase taxes on the wealthy so that the economy will become stronger, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Professor then said, well, that's basically, you know, like a handout to the people. And I said, well, what do you think we've been doing with the wealthy, you know, giving them tax breaks and everything? So that made her think. And then I just kept on explaining, you know, got information from like the Wall Street Journal or Financial Times. And I said, this is what we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
We need to increase taxes on the wealthy, cut taxes on the working class like us, so that our economy would become stronger. Because I said before, you know, Reagan's tax cut, what was like being in the middle class before they, you know, they dropped the tax tier down from 74 to like 30%. And she said, you know, come to think of it, taxes weren't that bad. I mean, you know, we lived comfortably. There was a single, you know, person, you know, family worker. The wife usually stayed home. Husband worked. Dad paid vacation. All this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then she thought about it for a while, and I said, well, look what happened. You know, when they started to cut taxes for the wealthy, they increased taxes on us, the middle class. Now, two people have to work two jobs?
Mm-hmm.
So I think, and I'm this is just my theory, I don't know how legit it is, but we, you know, I had to explain that I had to undo what Fox and all these right-wing pundits kept telling her.
Yeah, it's dirty work, but somebody has to do it, right, Tim?
Yeah, and I'm doing it by myself to, like, friends and to my professors, and they have to keep, unfortunately, they have to see the evidence. And it takes a long time to undo the damage that the Republicans have done to them, all the lies and everything.
Well,
and I'm glad for those shows like yours, by the way, because, and like Tom Hartman's also, because people are getting it, albeit slowly.
Well, I sometimes wonder, I really do, if people are getting it. And thanks, Tim. I appreciate your call. Thanks a lot, man. If people are starting to get it, I doubt if it's because of Hartman or me or anybody else. Nothing gets a person's attention quicker than to understand that he or she, and his or her entire life is about to go up in flames unless there are some essential, basic changes made. And I think possibly that's what's going on. Now, how those changes are made, it can be a violent change, which happens in so many countries, when everything is starting to tank except for a very select group at the top, or the change can come a little bit more gradually. I sometimes wonder what it's going to be in this country. We'll be right back. Before the hour, this is the story that got some attention, a lot of it disdainful attention from the right-wing crazy people in this country. An island of ice more than four times the size of Manhattan. Is drifting across the Arctic Ocean after breaking off from a glacier in Greenland. potentially threatening shipping lanes and oil platforms. Do you get that? A threat to oil platforms, ice breaking off because of global warming, which is caused in part by oil platforms that suck up oil that we then use to do just about everything. And now, they call this the revenge of the ice. It's heading for oil platforms. Woo! There's just something very circular about that, huh? The iceberg is moving toward the Nares, N-A-R-E-S, Strait, which separates the northwestern coast of Greenland and Ellesmere Island of Canada. If it makes it into the strait before the winter freeze, the iceberg will probably be carried south by ocean currents, hugging Canada's eastern coast until it enters waters busy with oil and shipping activities off Newfoundland. The European Space Agency spokesman said, quote, "That's where it starts to become dangerous," end quote. Scientists say this ice island is the biggest in the Northern Hemisphere since 1962. Well, see? There you go, Mike. There's a big one in 1962, Mike. Damn, that was 48 years ago. Boy, you left-wing hippies are all the time making such a big deal about ice breaking off. Oh, damn, I had this back in 62. There's something that has been discovered in Northern Canada that should drive the religious fundamentalists of all stripes, especially the three people of the book, crazy. Scientists found just a little bit beneath the crust in northern Canada, a chunk of pristine, undisturbed rock from the time when the Earth was nothing but molten rock. That puts it at around 4.5 to 5 billion years old. The evidence for this comes in the form of lava rocks that themselves are a mere 60 million years old. But these rocks contain an early Earth mixture of helium, lead, and neodymium isotopes, which suggest the mantle rock beneath the crust that yielded them is a virgin pocket of Earth's original material. 4.5 billion years old under Baffin Island. It has not been disturbed by plate tectonics or any sort of volcanic eruption that would force it to the surface. There it is. A geoscientist at Boston University, that's the second one we've had from Boston University today, said, "I was surprised that any of the original mantle, Earth's mantle, survived. Finding a piece of the original mantle," he went on, "has been a holy grail." You'll pardon the expression. "The original Earth was a big ball of magma. That's our planet's original composition. And here it is, a piece of it." The discovery, according, this is from Discovery News, which is put online by the Discovery Channel. The discovery has surprised other researchers as well. Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon, scientists there said, quote, "Even if a vestige of such material remained, it seems unlikely that it would be found in any samples from Earth's surface or the shallow subsurface that are available to geologists. Yet that is what this new evidence shows." Well, I wonder how the fundamentalists, the religious people, accept that. I mean, really, you know, the Earth, according to them, and there's some debate here, but at max, the Earth is only, the entire creation is only 10,000 years old. Everything. So when they discover something that makes that 10,000 years look like what it is, nothing. They discover something that's 4.5 billion years old or older. What, you know, I don't know. My grandmother, who was a Christian fundamentalist, although they wasn't referred to that way back at the time, 50 years ago when my grandmother passed, to me, she was just very religious. And it seemed to me that all Christians were that way. But my grandmother never had a problem with, she never talked about it, about, you know, Adam and Eve and dinosaurs or evolution. It never came up. And I guess that's because to my sainted grandmother, bless her heart, there was no debate. If it was in the Bible, it was real. If it was not in the Bible, it was fantasy. So. All right, tomorrow night, the program is a rebroadcast because I will be winging my way to, or already arrived in Seattle. Monday night, the program will be a rebroadcast because I will be winging my way back. So the next time I chat with you live will be Tuesday. That doesn't mean don't tune in. Tune in. And for those of you who can make it to the forum in Seattle, I'll see you there. Saturday night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. So